Welcome to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. When we think of what captivates us when we watch a movie, many things come to mind. Maybe it's the gripping performances, that powerful score, or a heart-wrenching story. But an essential component that may be easy to overlook is the way that characters are dressed. There's a rich tradition in movie costuming with its seams and sashes that transport us to another place, be that the Wild West, Regency England, or 1970s New York. The Decorative Art Center in Lancaster is showing Creating the Illusion, costumes and characters from the Paramount Pictures archive through August. If you're curious about the exhibit, you can find out more about that at our website at wosu.org/allsides, or you can join the conversation. If you've got a favorite movie costume you want to talk about, give us a call at 614-292-8513. Or email us, allsides@wosu.org. The exhibit's curator and an archivist at Paramount Pictures, Randall Thropp, joins us now by phone. Thanks for coming on, Randall.
Good morning. Nice to chat with you.
Nice to chat with you as well. Tell us, what is your definition of great costuming for film?
Well, great costuming really defines the character. I mean, really, the costume designer is a master of illusion when you think of it. That's hence the title of the exhibit, Creating the Illusion. The costume designer really helps define that character by the choice of fabrics, by the style that the person is wearing, or really completing the period. Again, as you said, if it's Regency England, it's really doing the research and coming up with the proper costumes and also the proper undergarments that make that costume look good on an actor. You have to have the proper fittings underneath to make a period costume look perfect, even for the 1950s. I mean, let's face it, women were wearing panty girdles and a different style of bra, and that helps give you that hourglass shape, and it's very different. So you do need to have the correct underpinnings to make the outer pinnings look great.
And do you think that viewers will notice that sort of difference, that granular? I mean, obviously, we're not watching a movie and thinking, there's no girdle on that woman. So how does that really affect the viewer's experience?
I don't know. I mean, I think the viewers sort of take it for granted that, well, the job has been done, and, oh, look, isn't that costume beautiful, and her waist is cinched in? Look at that small waist. Well, that small waist is not necessarily natural. It is the girdle or the corset that really, you know, completes that look, especially on Victorian garments. But I think viewers, you know, sort of take it for granted. But as a costumer and as working in the business as long as I have, I notice it, you know, and my friends notice it. It's like, well, that looks really good, you know. So, yeah.
When you think of that kind of definition you're putting out there of all those details being in place so that we can really take in the full picture, what do you think are the iconic moments of costuming in film?
Iconic moments. I mean, there are lots of iconic costumes. And I will say, just as a plug for Paramount, I mean, Paramount really defined a lot of looks over the years, going, you know, even back to Breakfast at Tiffany's and the dresses that Edith Head designed and Givenchy designed for Breakfast at Tiffany's. And then you get into films like Love Story, which really set a new trend. I mean, there's a lot of films that we did, Flashdance, Footloose, they just flew out of my head, but we did a great Gatsby. The Ralph Lauren suits that were done for Robert Redford really defined it. It set a trend for menswear. Same thing with American Gigolo with Richard Gere. The Armani suits really set a trend.
Really? So they had an impact past just the film they were in. They
influenced
fashion in the real world?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It influenced men's fashions. Again, with Flashdance, now you think back about Jennifer Beals and those sweatshirts that, you know, they cut the neck out of and sort of went off the shoulder. That became a trend. Those socks, those crunch socks that she wore, the dancers, like leg warmers,
yeah.
That became a very popular trend. Even most recently, I mean, in the last 20 years, like Clueless. I mean, some of those little short plaid mini skirts and mixing colors and patterns together, that came out of Clueless. So, Paramount, a lot of Paramount Pictures really defined fashion.
Well, that's something that interests me, too. I'm wondering if the fashion that is in these movies, like you think about Footloose, which was made in the 80s, about the 80s. I mean, that's just so iconic as an 80s film. Does
right.
it help kind of crystallize what a decade's fashion is to us as the popular culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Another example would be Pretty in Pink, the Pretty in Pink film. I mean, if you really look at that and look at the jewelry that Annie Potts is wearing, look at what Molly Ringwald is wearing, it really did cement. So, you know, young girls went out and started buying that stuff. And the guys, the way the guys are dressed with the sort of the vintage style jackets, Marilyn Vance did that film. And, you know, it really did that set a trend as well.
Interesting. I think it's also interesting when we look at costumes that are a little bit out there. One of the costumes that's going to be featured or that is featured in this exhibit are costumes from Coming to America.
Yeah.
And we actually have a clip from this film. It stars Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. And in this, they have just come to America and they're talking with a cab driver.
Are you sure you guys want to go to Queens? A couple rich fellas like you should be in Manhattan. Stay at the Waldorf or the Palace.
The Palace sounds good. Take us there.
No, I want Queens. We're not rich. We're ordinary African students.
And of course, the joke there, they're covered in kind of rich garb. You can absolutely tell they are not ordinary African students.
No. And really, it's great because Coming to America really has become sort of a cult classic now. I mean, it's really, and it holds up. We recently did a screening at the Drexel there in Columbus, and it really is amazing. The film still holds up. It's still funny. But I have to talk about the costumes for a second, which were designed by Deborah Nadulman Landis. And Deborah really, almost everything in the film was created from scratch. And the look that Eddie is wearing and what Arsenio was wearing in that scene that you just played the clip from, she based Eddie's look on an Indian Maharaja who was educated in the UK and had all of his suits made in London. And that was sort of her inspiration for the way Eddie's costume is put together. And that is the costume that is on display at the Decorative Arts. So you can see the details that went into that. But it's a beautifully tailored suit, but it's the coat that he wears on top of that, which is just fantastic. But I will tell you this, as far as the fabrics that were used in Coming to America, especially on the enormous party scene, which this is where the king and queen are trying to introduce Eddie to his chosen bride, which of course that doesn't work out, but they host this elaborate party for all sorts of dignitaries. And if you watch the film and you watch that scene, you'll see hundreds of extras dressed in beautiful, beautiful African fabric. Well, at the time, in 1987, when the film was, they started shooting, Deborah could not find that fabric with any quantity in the U.S. I mean, New York, Los Angeles, it just wasn't out there in quantity. So she had remembered seeing a vendor at the Brixton Market in London. And so she contacted that vendor, and they were able to get actual African fabric from West Africa and have it shipped to the United States in quantity so that she could cut all of these elaborate dresses and head wraps and scarves. And we have two of those on exhibit at the Decorative Arts, which are just, they're beautiful, but those are authentic West African fabrics. And also the jewelry was inspired by Northern Africa. A lot of Moroccan-inspired jewelry was used in the film. And so we have a necklace and then a set of earrings, which are on the mannequins, that you can see. But those are actually, and I believe it's the Falari tribe is what the earrings were inspired by. But yes, there's a lot of stories behind Coming to America and the challenges of getting the film to look the way it did. But yes, everything was built from scratch on that film, and it's quite remarkable.
I was going to say that feels, I mean, huge, that level of detail and the level of effort they went to get that. Is that normal? Is that what most movies do?
When you get to a film like that, at the time, what Deborah has said to me is, at the time, a lot of the research books that she was looking at for a West African, they were in black and white. So you weren't even sure what colors were being used. And that's when she had remembered seeing this fabric at the Brixton Market in London. And so, yes, a lot of research. For instance, on True Grit, which we have three costumes from True Grit, the 2010 remake with Jeff Bridges and Haley Steinfeld and Matt Damon, which Mary Zofries has said it was the most research she ever had to do on a film. And part of the problem was, if you think about the 1870s, 1880s, most photographs that are accessible to us, they're very posed. They're wearing their Sunday best. They're not wearing, you know, average street clothes at the time. So she found a lot of sources of mugshots, of prisoner shots from that period. So these guys, because they're basically, you know, they're accused of crimes, they're put in front of a camera, and they're wearing whatever they had on. So they're not wearing their Sunday best. And some of her inspiration for True Grit came from those photos. The story behind Haley Steinfeld's dress, which is on display, is her theory was that her mother probably made that dress as her best dress that she should wear into town to find out what happened to her father. And so it's made to look like, you know, a very conservative. Her mother crafted this dress. And all the fabrics that were used, Mary did a lot of research on the fabrics. So the fabrics are absolutely authentic for the period, which are the wools and the cottons that would have been true to the period of the 1870s, early 1880s. So yes, a lot of research. Now, with contemporary films, it's more about the character and what the character would want to wear, or the type of fabric the character would wear, or what accessories really define that character. But when it comes to a period film, yes, you really have got to do your research. And luckily with the internet now, it's a lot easier to do research. But back in the day, even like 10, 15 years ago, you were dependent on going to the library, getting books, or going to one of the studio research libraries and getting as much information as you could.
Wow. I mean, you describe that dress that Haley Steinfeld wears, and in the movie it is heavy. It's a black dress, I guess relatively form-fitting to the bodice, and then it's got almost like a Peter Pan white collar with it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it didn't occur to me when I was watching the film, but yes, it does feel like a little bit nicer. Like it is a nicer dress, and she seemed buttoned up, and it almost like contributes to her sense of purpose in some ways. You see her like straight as an arrow go to confront Jeff Bridges.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that they lived in the country, and this was her going to town dress, and her mother wanted her to look respectable, but still conservative. And so she gave her this task of going to find out what happened to her father and get some justice, but also to get some money for a horse. And so, you know, it's she had business to do. And so that is her city. It's referred to in the breakdown of the script as her city dress.
Okay. We are talking to Randall Thropp. He's the curator of Creating the Illusion, which is an exhibit at the Decorative Art Center in Lancaster. We are going to continue speaking with Randall in just a few moments. You're listening to All Sides Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm Claire Roth. Those costumes we see in movies might occasionally catch our eye, but sometimes they're meant to be in the background and contribute to the overall sense of what we are seeing on screen. Other times, a costume becomes synonymous with the movie, like Holly Golightly's classic little black dress and pearls in Breakfast at Tiffany's. This hour, we are talking about costume design in film and in history. The Decorative Art Center in Lancaster is showing Creating the Illusion, costumes and characters from the Paramount Pictures Archive through August. It features costumes from decades of film. Still with us by phone is exhibit curator Randall Thropp. And joining us now is curator of the Ohio State University Historic Costume and Textiles Collection, Gail Strugge. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Claire. Hi, Randall.
Oh, hello, Gail.
So you've created dozens of exhibits of costumes, and you've worked as a theatrical costumer. What stands out to you as hallmarks of a good costume?
Oh, gosh. I think it's always the thing that really promotes the character and the storyline. And a lot of times in costume, when you're working with the director, it's not that the costume itself is going to be historically accurate for the time period, but it really is more about the character and the play or the film or just telling the story.
Can you give an example of a character whose costume really helps illuminate, you know, what they're about?
Well, I think that, I mean, one thing that just comes to mind, and it's just really going to be something specific to me, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Harrison Ford, right? His leather jacket, his fedora hat, his pleated pants, and it's his pants that kind of get me, because when that movie was made in the 1980s, it was very popular, it's fashionable for men's pleated pants to be made out of a really drapey rayon fabric. And men's pants were just not made of rayon in the 1930s when that film was supposed to take place. So it's something that just recognizing the characteristics of that I pick up on and wouldn't really be that noticeable to a lot of other people. But that was just sort of one specific kind of thing. But when you get into some of the movies like Baz Luhrmann's
Moulin Rouge?
Not Moulin Rouge, the
Great Gatsby?
Yes, Great Gatsby. It's like, I know. The clothes that Daisy was wearing were not at all historically accurate, but they're more contemporary looking, and they were done by a contemporary designer. But I think it's really trying to make the actresses look attractive to the audience of their day, rather than maybe what might have been historically accurate and maybe not to our current eye, something that we would think of as being attractive, perhaps. So sometimes it's hairstyles, sometimes it's often it's makeup and hairstyles are of the time period that the movie's made, not necessarily.
Absolutely. That's what drives me crazy, are the bad hairstyles. When you're doing a period picture, and there was something I saw recently, I think it was, and I hate to you know, say anything, but it was The Last Tycoon, I believe, on Amazon, and I was like, the costumes look great. It was, you know, it's based on the F. Scott Fitzgerald short, the novella, and it takes place in the 1930s, and the hairstyles, oh my God, were so, I was like, I kept screaming at the television, like, somebody comb her hair, get it into place, put some spray on it. They just, it drove me nuts. It really did. But the costumes were beautiful, but the hairstyles, oh.
Yeah, and it's always fun, I think, to kind of compare when some movies are done over and over again, like Pride and Prejudice, or all of the different Robin Hoods over the time period, because you just, it's just so funny. You know, Kevin Costner with his mullet haircut, you know, in the 1990s, like, I don't think Robin would have been wearing that hairstyle. So it's things like that. And it's funny when you're talking about just recently seeing things, because I just, I might have been on AMC. I saw Pride and Prejudice and Vampires. And, you know, just totally different concept of a Jane Austen movie. But the costumes were remarkably really interesting and good. And it was fun to see the adaptations that they did for these Ampere style gowns and how they adapted them for hiding daggers underneath and, you know, swords and that kind of thing. It's like, just whip open the skirt of the dress and here I've got my knife and I can kill my vampire. So.
And you see, that's the genius of the costume designer, because the designer has got to figure that stuff out. And, you know, working with the director and the stunt coordinator as to, okay, well, how do we hide those knives? How do we hide stunt pads? You know, there's all sorts of things that go into a costume like that. When you're doing a very stunt-heavy film or something with a lot of blood work, it's like, yep, the costume designer has got to be, you know, on target there.
Right, and the how many variations of like one costume that you need for different shots?
Oh yeah, now that because I used to do a television series called Tales from the Crypt, and that was a very stunt-heavy, very blood, you know, lots of blood work in that. Usually we had four. We had four for the, because it's television, you've got to move quickly. With films, sometimes you'll have up to six, seven costumes that are rigged and ready to go in case the stunt doesn't work, or it's called squibbing when you're doing like gunshots. And if the squib doesn't go off, you've got to take it off the actor immediately, get a new scored costume on there with the squibs in place, and then the stunt coordinator approves it, and then you shoot the scene. So you've got to be prepared. So with feature films, because you have a little more time, a little more leeway, you can have sometimes up to six or seven costumes waiting.
Yeah, and it depends, too, on if you've got something that you want that close-up shot or something at a difference. If you really want to get some detail, then someone might have some really exquisite lace that they want on that close-up shot. And I know even with, again, with that Raiders of the Lost Ark, when Marion is suspended above Harrison Ford in the crypt, when they throw her into the pit of snakes, and you see she's got this wonderful 30s bias gown, but there's a hoop at the bottom of that gown that holds that dress out, so you get mm-hmm. that kind of effect, which mm-hmm. you wouldn't get with something that would more naturally cling to the body.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
You rig these kinds of things to get the effect that you want,
and
you know, and it's just totally unknown to the audience viewer. So, but
I was going
to
say, both of you are costumers, so tell us some of the intricacies of creating these costumes.
Gosh, I know just some of the, I haven't really done a lot in costume design recently, but there's definitely so much structure that goes into some of the underpinnings of these things
yes.
to get them right. And depending on the need of a certain costume, or if you need to do a quick change, you know, especially in theater, you know, you might have a dress that looks like it's totally buttoned down the front, but then those buttons don't really work. It's maybe some little Velcro pieces underneath, so they could quick get that off
mm-hmm.
and then, you know,
yes.
dip into something else, because they only have so many seconds that they need to be out in the next scene for the play. So there are things like that. And I think of some of the things I know when I worked on the exhibit, the Julie Taymor exhibit over at the Wexner Center, when they did it back at the beginning of this century, I think mm-hmm. it was just when Lion King first came out.
Mm-hmm.
So they had some of the costumes from the Lion King, including this beautifully beaded corset that, you know, goes on, you know, little junior Lion King's mother. And it's just stunning when you see this thing up close. And it was made at Barbara Matera's in New York, and I think it was like $3,000 just for this corset. But it was bound in leather. It had all this beading. And, you know, so much of that gets lost on stage because
yes.
Most of the audience is so far back.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it helps the performer, the actor or actress, you know, really, you know, especially for a position of royalty, to know that you have this really expensive kind of garment, I just think helps them with their character as well.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of stuff, even on film, gets lost. I mean, designers like Colleen Atwood put so much detail and little, small, wonderful bits into the costumes, but when you light that costume and it just suddenly gets lost on camera, even especially if it's a dark shot. You know, mm-hmm. you spend all this time and energy doing these beautiful costumes with layers of fabric and lots of detail and trims, but then when it's shot, it's like, oh, okay, well, I missed that entirely. But when you see it close up, it's like, I didn't realize this was on here, or that type of stitching was used on here, or that type of lace. But kind of going back to the theatrical costume idea, I just want to give a plug for Decorative Arts, is the costumes that are from Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, which are in the center hallway of the exhibit. There are three costumes designed by Joanna Johnston for a sequence in the film that is centered around the opera Turandot. And Joanna actually built those costumes as if they were theatrical costumes. And yes, there's Velcro. There's also what we call whopper poppers, which
yes.
are the great big snaps that are concealed. You wouldn't notice it, but they are constructed as if they were real theatrical, you know, operatic costumes for the production of Turandot. And also, in the film, because the camera is back so far from the stage, you don't get to really see all of the details that Joanna put into those costumes, which is great. At Decorative Arts, you can get right up close to them. But on the turquoise Turandot gown, all of that is hand-painted. The gold work on there is all hand-painted. So there's all sorts of details like that the camera kind of blurs it as well. You don't get to really appreciate that until you see them close up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, having worked in the costume shops at various places, you know, all the people that are working in there are, you know, this is their art. So they're
yes.
really, this is their craft. They're going in there and all of that detail, you know, how the things are stitched together, the
mm-hmm.
embellishment that goes on, or the distressing, you know, taking the clothes
yes.
to the cheese grater to try and get those
yes.
worn
an actual
parts.
Cheese grater?
Yes, actual cheese
yeah.
grater.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, take your denim, you know, before all of these pre-distressed blue jeans that you can buy in the stores
mm-hmm.
now, when you had to go in and actually make something look like it was worn in. Like you would
and it's not easy.
Yeah, no, it would take a while. Oh, sandpaper, cheese grater.
Yes.
Like, you would put like a man's wallet in the back pocket of a pair of jeans so you would get that worn
mm-hmm.
in look, and then just take the cheese grater or the sandpaper and try and
yeah.
wear off the look so that it looked like that wallet had been sitting in that pair of jeans for, you know, years.
Yeah, I have the utmost respect for Adria Dyers because, boy, they know their craft and they know all the little tricks for distressing, aging, making something look worn. I mean, it's brilliant what they come up with. And even close up, it's like, wow, this looks totally authentic. You begin to wonder, well, is this a used piece? And then there's six or seven of them, and it's like, oh, I guess not, because they all match. But yeah, Ager dyers are just remarkable. I've always been fascinated watching them work.
Yeah, and Randall, I think it must be great to kind of work with the archive there and really be able to see all of those details on things.
And, oh, yes.
You know,
yes.
Because when you, like you said, when you see it in the movie, you know, you get a certain look or a certain aspect of it. Or sometimes some things, they only zoom in and you see the top of a dress
absolutely.
Or something, and you just don't get to see the rest of it. And that's what's kind of fun for those of us that like to turn things inside out and see how did they do this?
You know? How did they do it?
Like, what? I need to figure out this puzzle because maybe I can use this again sometime.
Well, I imagine sometimes costuming is a little bit like being a good editor, where if you do your job really well, no one notices.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that, absolutely.
Sure.
I mean, costumes, I mean, yes, they define the character and they stand out, but they should... It should be an organic process. It should fit in with the mood of the film, or the theatrical production. It shouldn't stand out as like, whoa, what the heck, which fabric? Why is she wearing a hot pink in 1820? You know, it's like, that's not natural. But yeah, again, this goes back to research. You've got to do your research. You've got to, you know, you've got to really, you've got to do some things like that to make it, you know, look authentic and blend in and, again, be organic to the production.
Yeah, and I think probably some of the hardest things to really design are all of those futurist things because you know, we have no reference point really. So just trying to come up with, well, what are things going to look like in you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now? You know?
Well, I have to say that's something when I was doing my research for creating the illusion and putting together my PowerPoint presentation, giving some sort of sense of history. And really, there was a time period between 1967 and 77 where everything was natural looking. It was very realistic. A lot of producers felt that they didn't need costume designers, but I'll tell you, two films changed all of that. One was Star Wars, the other one was Star Trek. And then suddenly the costume designer had to create, along with the production designer and the director, had to create entire worlds from scratch. So not only do you have the crew of the Enterprise and what would they be wearing, but also you've got to look at all of these aliens that are populating the background, the scenes. And again, you have Klingons, you have, you know, Vulcans. What would they be wearing? What does a Vulcan teacher wear? What does a Vulcan, fighter wear? You know, you really had to create all of that from scratch. So suddenly the costume designer became all important again. If these science fiction films are going to take off and be popular as they are today, you need a costume designer to complete all of that.
Absolutely. We have a call from Alan in Clintonville. Alan, you're on the line now. Tell us what you'd like to add to the conversation.
Well, I taught theater history at a large local university for many years. And at one point, I did an illustrated lecture on history of costume. And I found images of Cleopatra. This was at the time that the Liz Taylor movie was coming out. And although I found that in many instances the costumes had been carefully researched and were carefully historically accurate, as your guest mentioned, the underwear remained of the period, as did the hairstyles. So Liz Taylor's Cleopatra had teased hair that was early 1960s, very high and bouffant. And my point when I taught it was that what we see every day as normal is invisible. We don't even notice it. Because it's everybody had teased hair, so you see Cleopatra with teased hair. You don't pay any attention to the hair. You're looking instead at the makeup that might be struck back, and particularly at the costume.
But now, as we look back on that film, it stands out.
Right. And Cleopatra is a great one because if you go back to Claudette Colbert in the 30s or Theda Bara in the 20s, their makeup was and their hairstyles were, you know, just so... right for the 30s or the 20s. And, you know, so yeah, it's that really kind of lets you know when the movie was made. It kind of looks a little bit dated.
I will say this, though, on the Paramount production, which was Cecil B. DeMille's Cleopatra with Colbert, it is an Art Deco masterpiece.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, when you
it's
watch
beautiful.
That film, It really is beautiful, but it is totally of the period as
right.
far as the women's clothing and the hairstyles. And look at the makeup. It's like, oh, my gosh, this is definitely early 1930s.
Yeah, so a lot of times if you're doing your historical research for a particular film, necessarily looking back at all the old movies, mm-hmm. you have to, you know, use that with a grain of salt because it might not necessarily be accurate for doing the period films. I love looking at them for those movies that are set in their time period, like movies
from
the 40s.
I will have to interject, though, on something yeah. at Paramount in the archives that we have that goes to the point of this, is with the Ten Commandments. The 1956 version of the Ten Commandments, I will say that DeMille had an amazing team of researchers, and we have a lot of the jewelry pieces from the Ten Commandments.
Cool.
And in doing the research, Jackie Rohr, who oversees our jewelry archive at Paramount, she did a lot of research at the Academy and with the Cecil B. DeMille Foundation, and those pieces are absolutely accurate. They took them from sketches and from rubbings that had been done from years ago that were in all sorts of old research books. But yes, those pieces of jewelry were absolutely authentic to the period. And we did loan, we have a headdress that was worn by Anne Baxter in the film. It's a gold headdress that she wears that has a vulture on the front of it. And it was loaned to the Rijksmuseum in the Netherlands. And they said it was the finest example they'd ever seen of that piece, the reproduction of that was used for the film. So even they were impressed with it. They had an Egyptology exhibit. They were very impressed.
Yeah, and I think that there certainly are those standout films that really do things that are historically accurate.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so they're, and so many of the BBC productions are just,
beautiful.
Merchant Ivory films are just beautiful.
We're talking about movie costuming right now on All Sides Weekend. My guests, Randall Thropp, curator of Creating the Illusion exhibit and the costume archivist for Paramount Pictures, as well as Gail Strugge, the curator of the Ohio State University's Historic Costume and Textiles Collection. We're going to take just a short break, and we'll be back in just a moment with more. Welcome back to All Sides Weekend. I'm your host, Claire Roth. We are talking about the suits, the dresses, the out-there outfits that grace the silver screen. From the black leather jumpsuit of Edward Scissorhands, to the ornate gowns of Queen Elizabeth from the film Elizabeth, to the yellow tracksuit in Kill Bill, these costumes give us a glimpse into the characters' inner lives and the story's outward themes. The Decorative Arts Center in Lancaster is featuring many costumes in their exhibit, Creating the Illusion. It goes through August. You can learn more about that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a favorite costume design you'd like to talk about, you can join our conversation by calling 614-292-8513 or by sending us an email at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us by phone is Randall Thropp, the curator of the exhibit and the costume archivist for Paramount Pictures, and as well, curator at the OSU Historic Costume and Textiles Collection, Gail Strugge, is still with us. Tell us a little bit about how we've talked a little bit about this, but how it differs movie to movie, Randall. You did some horror, and obviously you have to have multiple outfits for that, because once blood gets on a costume,
yeah.
if you want to do another take. But, doing period pieces compared to something modern like Rogue One, where do those differences come in?
Well, again, the difference is, when you're doing a contemporary film, a lot of times, because of budget constraints or time constraints, those films are shopped. The costume designer will come up with an idea, a concept, discuss it with the actor, the director, and then it's basically shopped at a department store. There are alterations made to them to make the costume fit. But with a period costume, again, we go back to research. You've got to do your research, you've got to know your fabrics, and you've got to find the proper source for those fabrics. works. And again, it's very usually with a period film, there's a lot more prep time than there is for a contemporary film. Now, if a contemporary film is full of stunts, then yes, there's a little more leeway on that. But generally, if it's a straightforward, you know, contemporary film, the prep time is generally 1 month or so. But if you're talking about a film like right now, well, this is a big secret. I don't think it's a big secret anymore, but we're actually doing a Top Gun. We're doing a sequel to Top Gun, and the prep time on that is about 3 months, given the stunts and that sort of thing.
Gotta buy those aviators.
Yeah.
I wonder if they're going to show up all over creation again.
Good question.
Were so hot, you know, in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And hey, may come back.
That kind of example of movies setting a trend for actual real life. Talking about period costumes, I want to play a clip from the movie Dreamgirls, a 2006 film with Jennifer Hudson and Beyonce. In this clip, their manager, who's played by... Jamie Foxx. He talks about the next step in their careers.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting the dreams. Dreamettes, little girls, you women now.
See, Dean, I told you.
We open in a week, so we got a lot of work to do. We're going to have a lot of changes. I'm bringing on Jolly Jenkins to stage a whole new show. He's done movies, Broadway, club acts, you name it. New wigs, the expensive kind. Brand new costumes to appeal to a younger crowd.
So tell us about those costumes, Randall.
Oh, the costumes from Dreamgirls. I was always so impressed with them. I love the film, number one. I mean, the film is terrific. Sharon Davis was the designer on Dreamgirls, and I have to say, Sharon had a very tight budget, considering how many looks the women go through in that film, and the men, too, because it evolves from the early 1960s through the 1970s, through the disco era. So you have a pretty wide arc there of styles, and I think she did a brilliant job, and she really did. She shopped. She got a lot of fabric. She did a lot of. Economical fabrics and made them look like high-end costumes. She really did a brilliant number. And we have the three blue sequin dresses, which are at Decorative Arts right now, but also Jennifer Hudson's two-piece suit that she wears during the signature number. And I am telling you, I'm not going, which is just brilliant. And yes, it's a copper-colored brocade suit with black fur trim. And very, very true to the period, which would have been the mid-1960s. And so we have those on display. They're the centerpiece of gallery, too.
Something I think that's really interesting about that is it's not just, oh, we have to depict a 60s group like the Supremes. It's we have to depict them in different stages of their career.
Yes. So you see them as young women just starting out. And again, they're basically wearing dresses they probably bought off the rack, which, again, Sharon had to make all of those because the three girls were all slightly different sizes. And so everything had to be custom made for Dreamgirls. So, yes, you see them starting off as young girls. Probably they were in high school and they were singing. And then it evolves. And actually, with the Beyonce character, she becomes a real high fashion statement. And again, on a budget, you've got to know what you're doing to pull off something that looks like couture or looks, you know, very, very high end. And Sharon did it. Sharon did a brilliant job on that film.
Well, I think the nice thing, you know, at least with the costume shops, too, probably the only place that you're going to get made to measure clothing is in a theatrical or Hollywood costume shop, you know, outside of couture houses, because you just don't get that anymore. So so at least because you have that ability in these shops to be able to make that happen, it, you know, makes it a little more easy to get that custom-made look.
And, oh, yes.
You know, as long as you've got the great fabric and
but
the great design.
It has to fit perfectly.
Yeah.
We have a call from Chris in Asheville. Chris, tell us what you'd like to share today.
You can't talk about costume design in films without talking about Edith Head, and I think one of her best outings was in Vertigo, the way she costumed Kim Novak. The first time you see her is when Scotty, played by Jimmy Stewart, first sees her in the restaurant Ernie's. She's wearing this teal and black number that just gives her a transcendent desirability that makes you understand, in a way, his obsession with her character. As a matter of fact, everything she wears in the film is great and has to do with her appeal to him. Just some comments about that. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that. Yeah, Ohio native Edith Head, she won, I think, 8 Academy Awards for costume design. What set her apart?
Edith was really quite brilliant. She didn't come from a fashion background at all. And she started at Paramount in 1924, and she left in 1967 to go to Universal, where she remained until 1981. Edith knew, she was a diplomat. Edith knew how to deal with directors, producers, and the actors. She also knew how to camouflage figure flaws that the actresses have, and that's what really endeared her to a lot of actresses, especially Barbara Stanwyck. And Stanwyck, Dorothy L'Amour, they all respected Edith because suddenly she was able to give them a new silhouette. Now, back to Vertigo for just a second, because Vertigo is a masterpiece. I mean, it's one of my favorite films. There's a classic story about Edith and Kim Novak, and Kim said absolutely the only color she did not like and didn't look good in was gray. And, of course, Hitchcock was insisting that she wear a gray two-piece suit, insisting. He says, I don't care whatever else she wears, she's got to have a gray two-piece suit. And so Edith did whip up, and actually I have a two-piece black suit that says Kim Novak inside of it, and I have a feeling she whipped up a black suit to show Kim Novak and to discuss with her why a black suit would not work for this character. The reason Hitchcock, from what I have read and been told, that wanted that gray suit and insisted on it is he wanted Kim Novak to emerge from the San Francisco fog and to be part of that aura, that sort of that wonderful mystery and that wonderful ambiance of San Francisco, that when because she's got the blonde hair, the pale skin, and that gray suit, and there was a reason why he wanted her in that gray suit. And so Edith did. She won her over and was able to get the gray suit on her, and she looked great. I mean, it's iconic. It's just beautiful. But yes, the costumes. Also, the costumes in Vertigo really do tell the story. They really perpetuate her story arc, and again with her change in hairstyle and makeup and everything as well. But it's a brilliant film. If you haven't seen it, please watch Vertigo. It's a terrific film.
Can we talk a little bit about the journey that we've been talking mostly about women, but some men too, take mm-hmm. to become costume designers? Gail, I know you've looked at this. How do people actually become costume designers? People like Edith or like Sophie Wachner?
Well, a lot of times there's definitely, I mean, in the case of Sophie Wachner, who was born in Akron, she was from Akron. She emigrated here when she was 6 months old. But she was in business as a dressmaker with her aunt and had gotten connections with Florence Ziegfeld and Charles Dillingham, who were producers on Broadway, and worked doing both the dressmaking and, you know, kind of starting out doing some gowns for different productions, and then eventually kind of ended up doing entire productions. And I think Sophie then continued in the 1920s. I think there was a stint she had. She went out to become the director of costume at Goldwyn Studios in 1919, which in 24 became MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And she finished there at 24, but then wasn't working at Fox until 27 or 28. So those couple of years in between, she had opened up a dress shop on Wilshire Boulevard. And so she was going back and forth between the clothing design and the costume design. And there have been a number of Hollywood costume designers who have done that same kind of thing. Irene Lentz Gibbons had worked at Bullock's Wilshire and had kind of become a favorite of some of the actresses because of the clothes that she would do for them. And then she followed Gilbert Adrian at MGM. And Adrian was another one who had a brilliant career as a costume designer in Hollywood. And then in 1940, started his own fashion line. And he ended up, and he did the costumes, and probably one of his iconic actresses was Joan Crawford. Mm-hmm. And he did the clothes for her, and those very broad shoulders and that nipped-in waist of the 1940s, that look was something that he also thought was a quintessentially American fashion for a sort of athletic American woman compared to a European woman. And so in 47, when Christian Dior came along with his new look, which was that anti-Joan Crawford look, it was rounding the shoulders, nipping in the waist, flaring out the skirt. Adrian refused to go along with that fashion change. And he, in his clothes, still maintained that broad-shouldered, narrow-hipped look of Joan Crawford. But I think, you know, the Dior thing kind of took over because people had had enough of that look all through the war, and they just really wanted a change. So even though Adrian argued against it, he didn't get his way. So
I'm curious about how women have been able to excel in this industry. We look back to even Edith, that's the first half of the 20th century.
Yes.
Back when even the heads of fashion houses were still men.
Yes.
Why is it that women were able to excel in this industry where that was really not the case in most other Hollywood roles?
Well, again, I think Edith as a woman appealed to the actress's ego in that she, the male designers designed for themselves and for the glamour of the actress, whereas Edith took into consideration the shape of the body, the actress, and what that costume would contribute to the character. And I think, you know, as an actress or an actor, you had to respect that because it only helped your performance. So I think that is one of the reasons Edith excelled for so long. But also, again, she pleased producers and she pleased directors. She also was notorious for reusing things. She would design an outfit and then maybe 2 years later have it completely recut, have shoulders put in differently or change the neckline and use it on somebody else. So she was saving money as well.
Yeah, and I think when I was looking into the research on Sophie Wachner, there were a lot of fan magazines for the silent movie era in the 20s. And so they would get a lot of actresses to comment in there. And there were, I think there was Norma Shearer had really talked about the costumes that Sophie had done for her. And she just complimented how Sophie helped her work with what colors look good on her and what silhouettes were kind of the things that really worked. And a lot of times the actresses really thought that the female costumers really understood the female form more.
Yes.
They certainly, I mean, those comments were made in some of those fan magazines. So, and it's, you know, and I'm sure that it's still part of the tradition too of, you know, sewing and fashion design was kind of typically more the, you know, a female realm. And, you know, even though there were, you know, still a lot of great French fashion designers that were making women's clothes in the couture houses. So,
we have just a few moments left, but I'd like both of your perspectives on how this industry has evolved over time, where you think it's come from and how it's really significantly changed in just, you know, a minute or so each. Randall?
The industry is always evolving. And again, now with television and HD, high definition, you've got to be even more accurate with your hairstyles, your makeup, your costumes, because the details, they're right there in your living room on a very large screen, just like a movie theater, but you can freeze frame those and you can look at it. So I think people are paying a lot more attention to detail, especially on period films, with the costumes because of HD television. But I do have to say, since I only have a minute left, I want to get a plug in for Creating the Illusion. Due to popular demand, we have extended the run. We're going to be running now until August 19th, and I will be in Ohio to do tours on the 18th and 19th, which is Saturday and Sunday, and I will be doing tours at either 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock each day, and you can call ahead and make a reservation if you like. So there, we got the plug in. Gail, your turn.
that's great news, Randall. I'm glad to hear that that the show's extended.
Oh, huge. It's been very, very popular.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We've got just about 30 seconds, Gail.
As Randall said, I think it is with HD, I think the attention to detail is certainly more heightened than it maybe has been. And because there are a lot of things that you could get away with, you know, it's like if you can't see it on a flying white horse in the background, you know, I don't have to worry about what that looks like. But now you do. So it's something
more and more detail oriented.
Yeah. So it is. And that's kind of nice because then, you know, if you're going to all that work to create all that detail, people can see it.
The audience can appreciate it. Gail Strege, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Gail Strege is the curator of the Ohio State University's Historic Costume and Textiles Collection. And Randall Thropp, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Randall Thropp is the curator of the Creating the Illusion exhibit and the costume archivist for Paramount Pictures. You've been listening to All Sides Weekend. The staff of All Sides includes assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, the All Sides interns, Martin Coleman, Alexandra Havlicek, Scott Good, and Ray Bruster. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.